Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 5, Episode 11 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio we have...
Hello everybody, welcome aboard.
It's mostly Kaylee. I'm not quite all here today. I'm a bit sick.
Happy New Year to you all.
Yes.
Yeah, did you have a nice New Year's?
I had a very lovely New Year's. New Year's Eve I spent watching The World's End.
Aww.
At home.
How appropriate.
Reacquainting myself with the end of civilization as we know it. And it was good, very pleasant. And it was one of those summer breaks where even if it wasn't actually raining all the time, it felt like it was raining all the time. Mm. And as a result, watched quite a lot of movies.
Well, it's been so bad here in Wellington. I've got to say, I went up yesterday to Auckland Port to snap up a little bit of the tennis. And when I got off, opened the door on the plane and walked out, it was like I was hitting a tropical island. I forgot what the sun was like in the heat. It was amazing, actually. Me and Bex were like, what the heck? This is like Fiji. We've just walked into Fiji. Given how cold and sort of week in, week out, it's been pretty average.
Yeah. I must say, down here. And I've talked to a few people who did get away from Wellington over the break. Some people went to Hawke's Bay and said it was fantastic. Mm. Some people went to Nelson and said it was better than we had here.
Nelson was
mostly good. Yeah.
I got a sunburn in Nelson, so it couldn't be that bad.
Well, that's pretty good going.
It is. Mm. It is. So, on today's show, there's been a lot happening at the movies. We took 2 weeks off, and mm-hmm. this is the first time ever in the history of the show we've actually taken that amount of time off, so there's a lot to catch up on. The Wolf of Wall Street, August, Osage County. Have I pronounced that right?
Osage.
Osage County, Short Term 12, Philomena, and The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. They're all the main topics, but we might sneak a few comments in about some others, Anchorman 2 as well. I saw this the other day. All of that and more in this week's episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast. But first, what is in the mailbag, Kaylee?
There's a lot.
I bet.
So I'm just going to go with a small tasting platter of what's going on
Lots
Twitter.
Lots of people complaining about not being able to hear all of the interviews in our best of the year shows.
Sorry, that was a bit awkward.
Yeah, that was entirely my fault, and I'm blaming Steve Jobs for bugs in GarageBand. But they're all present and correct, and it was actually only my voice that you were missing out on. You heard the people I was interviewing. It was just my half that wasn't there. So some would say that's an improvement, but if you go back to them now, the special two-part Best of 2013 episodes, 9 special guest presenters in 7 countries in 5 continents. Just,
it's awesome. Fantastic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So let's start way back on the 30th of December last year. Miriam Ruth Ross, one of our 3D experts, says all the way from the UK, 47 Ronin, Mono Keanu. Ooh.
Yeah, and that opens today, doesn't it? Around town.
Mm. Mm. Tin Ribs 27, trying to come up with a Wolf of Wall Street two-word review for Cinematica, and all I've got is good phallus, which doesn't really make sense.
I liked it.
But appropriate, isn't it?
Yeah. With the follow-up tweet, it does make me giggle, however. Oh, so many. Oh, yes, Blair Macca, two-word review for Alan Partridge, Split Sides, and two-word review for Wolf of Wall Street, End Times.
Yep. I'm glad to see people are still getting to Alan Partridge. You know, one of the favourite films of the year for at least two of us around this table.
That's right. Yeah, I couldn't. I went with my better half, and she kind of didn't see it the same way. I've got to say, it's interesting.
She still shouted you to the tennis.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's love.
But isn't it funny though that I think it still kind of it either hits or it doesn't.
Yep,
it's an interesting film.
Mm. Mm.
The ever epic Fred Thompson, two-word review for August, Osage County, tragic dysfunction, at times depressing to watch, but worth catching a superb Chris Cooper.
Yeah. We would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And from Reese Pie all the way over in the UK, two-word review for American Hustle is American Hairstyle. And was De Niro really supposed to look like Scorsese?
Well, we haven't seen that yet. They're a little bit ahead of us in the UK. Not always ahead of us. Sometimes they're behind us. But in this particular case, American Hustle is when here?
The 23rd of January?
23rd of January. Okay.
According to the crystal ball.
Yeah, not very far away.
Not far at all.
Mm. Yes. And if you'd like to read some more tour reviews, you can head over to our Twitter feed, which is at Cinematicacast. Yep. Lots of goodies over there.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so we've talked about the weather, and this is usually the weather is a very strong indicator of how many people are going to go to the movies and how often across this period. Has it been a good couple of weeks for cinema owners? I ask somebody who might know.
I think it has. I think it has, though, probably first and foremost because of the product, the strength of the product. So that's good. You know, there's some really good films in there, and they're holding well. So it's on the back of The Hobbit. You know, you had this other momentum that kicked in, which is great. So I think on the whole, it's got a pass mark. Yeah.
Okay. It felt a little bit a light on stuff for kids. Like once you'd seen, if you saw The Hobbit before Christmas and then Frozen on Boxing Day, you sort of ran out of options.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though, interestingly, I think Mitty is a young teens film. Right. I think it can work in that way. I don't know if it is.
Well, we took the almost 11-year-old to Mitty, and it was certainly nothing. There was no content in it that would upset them.
Whether it holds their attention.
That's
isn't
right.
It?
Yeah.
But my 13-year-old daughter went and adored it and felt like a real adult watching it. I think you know, like it was her sort of first.
Okay,
sort of adult
so that's
film.
That's good time.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Mm. So and we've seen it through the cinema. You know, this sort of younger group of people checking out Mitty, and with those films, as with Alan Partridge, you know, you get that second one. You get that holiday time and you get that break where people have actually got some time to think about what they want to go and see. And you get this little surge on these films, which is, you know, nice to see.
All right. What have people been going to see? What's our top five?
Right. In at number five, down from four, Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues.
That's this weekend, isn't it? The last, the 4 days of this weekend.
Yeah, 2nd to the 5th of January. Right. In at number four, up from five, Wolf of Wall Street. Sitting at number three is Philomena. At number two is Frozen. And in the number one position, The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
And
4 weeks in release. Right. I don't know if it's been number one the whole time. But
I think it has been. Probably. But I read somewhere that that film was the number one film in New Zealand for 2013, just based on the 3 weeks that it had.
I haven't seen that.
Pre-Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's done over 7.5 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that would, because that would be bigger than Iron Man, I think.
But the Hobbit was 11 plus, I think, from memory.
But a lot of that was in the year.
Oh, previous. Sure. Yeah, sure. No, I think it's, and that's another film that I think people have actually worked out when they want to go and see it. So, you know, over a 3 or 4 week period, that's when the weather's bad. Okay, we've got 3 hours to kill. Let's go and see it. You know, whereas maybe with the first one, there was more of a rush at the front.
Yeah,
which has been interesting to see.
Well, look, well done. This is, I think, the most exciting, apart from film festival period, maybe this is the most exciting time of the year to be a film buff in this country, because all of the big Academy Award contenders are basically hitting week in, week out now, some up against each other. We'll start off with one that I think is going to be a very much a contender for performance awards this time around. Time to go to, where is Osage County?
Oklahoma.
Let's go to Oklahoma.
You ready for this?
No way.
Hey, Mom, I'm here.
Oh, Mom, you're so big. Look at your boobs. Last time I saw you, you looked like a little boy.
Soon you'll be gone, never to return.
Don't start with that.
My father, you broke his heart when you moved away.
That is wildly unfair.
You were Beverly's favorite, you know that.
I prefer to think my parents loved their children equally.
I'm sure you prefer to think that Santa Claus brought you presents, too.
August, Osage County. Is it called August because it's in August?
I believe it's so insanely hot. They keep talking about how hot it is, and I was like, I'm guessing that's the month that it's
right.
In.
It's not it's a town called August.
No, it's they're in a. I think yeah. I don't know. I don't think they're in a town called August. They're out in the burbs.
No, I'm pretty exactly.
The
I'm
burbs
pretty,
of Oklahoma, which is the plains.
The plains, exactly. Well, I'm pretty sure that it is in fact August because of the month. Osage County, Oklahoma, based on a play that has basically stormed the world. Steppenwolf Theatre in Chicago was where it started. It went to Broadway, went to London. Even Wellington got a version of August Osage County at Circa Theatre. And now we get the big screen version with, you know, star-studded cast. Mm-hmm. So, Kaylee, what did you make of it?
I adored this film. This is good. It's a good bridge between our end of year show in the beginning, because I was complaining, it's like, where are all the women in Hollywood? Where are the roles
for them?
They're
all in one film.
They're all there.
Opens on the 1st of January 2014. Just said, wait, a whole calendar year. What can you say about a film that has Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts and, you know, Ewan McGregor and Dermot Mulroney and Juliette Lewis and Chris Cooper and all these other incredible actors? It's like, it's fantastic. It's really well paced, because it starts you off, you're introduced to this whole family who are getting together around a tragedy, which is not a spoiler, it's in the trailer. And it's this just completely dysfunctional family that sort of tries to get together but ends up falling apart and pushing each other away. And
they're not just falling apart. This is like they're like shrapnel at the end of a hand grenade explosion. This is, you know, they're being blown apart by so much all coming to a head at once. There's the matriarch, Meryl Streep. She's got this long-standing drug addiction to various drugs, and so she's basically out of control. And then, I mean, we won't go too far into it, but there are skeletons, and there are closets, and there are skeletons coming out of closets, and it's very, very well crafted, isn't it, how these things get revealed, and at the time they get revealed, where we were sitting in a screening of this with general public, and there was one particular audience member about two rows behind us that just kept saying, "Oh no!" every single reveal, and
it's working a treat, isn't it?
Exactly,
it's fantastic. It's,
you know, on some levels, that could be really, really irritating. But you know, people responding to it is great. You know, that's like big laughs. So you know, it was really working for people.
It's funny you say that, because you know, I haven't seen it yet, but I've chatted to some customers in the foyer and that sort of thing, and you know, some of them have come out a bit bewildered, I think, or a bit I wouldn't say that, but they've still enjoyed it. But it's not it was not what they didn't expect Meryl to have that sort of role. And I think would you say that this is actually quite a new or you know, a fresh role for her that we haven't seen before?
Look, I'll tell you what I thought. For the first scene, I thought, oh, this is going to be Meryl Streep acting, isn't it? This is going to be one of those ones where she's acting. But then, you know what? She's so good, she becomes this person. And you just forget that, you know, she's putting on a bit of an accent, she's got a bit of a wig happening, and, you know, there's it could have been terrible. It could have been really awkward, but she is as good as she has always been. Mm. You know, it's just like, God damn it, how do you do this? But there are a couple of people that I would in that cast that I want to highlight. One is Julia Roberts, who we just don't see enough of in serious roles. She is the bee's knees. She's really good, and she's the heart and soul of this picture. Like, this picture is built on her reaction shots, you know, her watching and listening and sighing to what's going on around her. The other one that I want to mention is Margot Martindale, who plays the sister Maddie Faye. And you'll know her face. She's been a supporting actress for years and years and years, but she is awesome in this, and she is every bit as good as the big stars around her. So now, I know a lot of people that haven't really got this. They think it's kind of overwrought or melodramatic, and it is quite theatrical in its structure, so perhaps people who've watched a lot of theatre will get more out of it than a normal audience, or perhaps an audience that doesn't go to the pictures as often. But I really got a kick out of this film. I got a kick out of the performances, the writing, the craft.
After watching the film version of it, I really, really want to see the stage version of it, because I can just imagine how much more, like, crazy it must be, just all these actors on one stage yelling at each other on like one set for 2 hours.
It could be wonderful, or it could be absolutely, you know, you might,
I think it'd be devastating, but it'd be in the best way possible.
Good word. All right, so two words for August Osage County.
Starstruck.
Okay, my two words for August Osage County: trigger warning. Because, you know, if you've actually, I could go with trigger warning for about three of the films that we talking about today. But there's some stuff going on in that family that could easily upset people, let's be honest. All right. Next up, we're going to go to Ireland.
I know this woman. She had a baby when she was a teenager. She's kept it secret for 50 years.
You're talking about a human interest story, and that's... I don't do those.
Why not?
You think I should do a human interest story?
I only want to know if he's all right.
Perhaps these older nuns could help us with some of the details.
I don't think that's going to be possible.
Why not?
You're a journalist.
I used to be.
Martin's a Roman Catholic.
Yes, well, no, I used to be. My guess is that Anthony was adopted and sent to America.
I think I would like to go. I'd like to know if Anthony ever thought of me. I've thought of him every day.
Philomena, starring Steve Coogan, and also co-written and produced by Steve Coogan with his serious hat on. We were talking earlier on about Alan Partridge and what a funny film that is. So last year, you'd have to say the year of Steve Coogan, or at least the December, the month of Steve Coogan. Philomena, Simon, you have seen this one for us. And what did you?
We've all knocked this off, though, haven't we?
I think, from memory.
Yeah, it's good. So we've all had it. We've all shed a tear, haven't we?
Just and a few gasps.
Gotten emotional. Yeah,
and
that's
a few,
right.
Oh, no!
Well, I mean, it's been a wee while since we've seen Judi Dench on the screen in a sort of role that, you know, isn't Mr. or supporting Mr. Bond, I guess.
Yeah.
And she is absolutely stunning in this, and she plays, as a young woman, somebody who falls pregnant in the 1950s and is pretty much just put into the Catholic Church to deal with it, I guess, and the treatment that she receives is pretty appalling, and she is looking for her adopted or long lost son, and Steve Coogan plays a journalist who's kind of, well, he's redundant, isn't he, and he's not really doing much. He's looking for things to do and trying to claw back his political career.
Hit rock bottom.
Yeah,
and he's looking for a new start,
and he sort of joins her in a crusade, I guess, to find her son and to also produce a story as a result and get his career back on track. And the thing is with this film is that I know what I was going to get with Judi Dench. The question mark for me was whether or not Steve Coogan could actually pull off this role and be likable, because quite often he's not likable.
Yeah, what Maisie knew.
Yeah. And he's not playing a... And initially you're not... He's not that warm, you know. He doesn't. He's not somebody that you're warm to, I don't think. But as the film progresses, he does, and he takes up her cause with, you know, the sort of passion and anger that you'd expect most people to do. Because there is a point in the film where you're very, very angry about how she's been treated, and the tragedy of it all. And yet she doesn't have that rage, but his character does, and he does it really well.
It becomes his crusade to a degree, doesn't
it? Yeah.
And I loved the fact that that what could have been a very flat arc for his character, he gets as much of a journey as she does, and I think that balance, I think, is really,
yeah,
she teaches him as much
he's a better person for it, isn't he, I think, at the end of it all. And I found it a bit of a roller coaster and a few surprises in there, which, you know, I thought was really nice the way they were handled. So
yeah, they kept a few things out of that trailer, didn't they? Which I think, and we're going to do our best not to go too far into those things, because it really is a film that is best off only knowing the premise, really, rather than too many details about what goes on.
So I mean, a fascinating film for me. You know, I guess we've seen that sort of thing before with other films in the past about this sort of pretty harsh treatment of young teenagers.
Yeah, there was a film called The Magdalene Sisters, many years ago, which dealt with the what happened at the time rather than the fallout from it. But this is sort of, you know, 50 years on.
And Judi Dench produces this amazing sort of naivety towards the world, as well as this kind of little but then there's these little sort of snippets of kind of a wild side, I guess, and things like that, which I think, you know everyone has, and so it's just interesting how they sort of come out, and she plays the role just superbly, I think.
Yeah, well, and you think that there's not actually anybody else that could really have played that part, you know. That's what the sign of a really great performance is, when you're not going, oh, you know, if Meryl Streep had done it, you know, would have been better or something. You know, Judi Dench, just tremendous, and really a nuanced portrait of a character that you think is going to be not so complicated,
But, you know, it succeeds in making you care. It succeeds in sort of reminding you about what took place in that time with certain, you know, for certain people. And it is, I wouldn't call it a roller coaster, but it is an emotional journey, and you do really buy into it. And I think, yeah, I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was great.
Mm. Do you have two words?
Can you
sum it up?
Well, I'm just going to say, you know, dark history, sad times in a way.
Yeah, both of those work well. Mine would be something like, if I can, rage tears.
Rage tears. Yeah, because there is a point where you get quite angry, isn't there? And you really want to, you don't feel like enough is being done, but then she just subdues that with a real form of sort of great grace.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think?
I'm going to go with True Journey.
Definitely.
Very good.
All right, time for the news.
I feel like we're just powering through the show today.
Well, seeing as the last one was like 2.5 hours, more than that, might have been close to 3 by the time we'd split it into 2 parts.
Oh, okay. Well, in the news today, veteran film producer Saul Zentz passed away on January the 3rd. He was 92 years old. Zentz ran a jazz record label before turning to the film business in the mid-70s, producing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975. He was also known for producing Academy Award winners Amadeus and The English Patient. For many years, he owned the rights to J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings books and produced Ralph Bakshi's animated version of the story in 1978, which, if you have seen it, you know why I'm laughing. Can't even talk about it without laughing.
Yeah, and if you've been following the Peter Jackson story about Lord of the Rings, Saul Zance's name comes into it quite often in terms of negotiating the rights away, because he still owned the rights to The Hobbit even after the Lord of the Rings films were made by Peter Jackson. So, his hands were all over it, basically, even when they were trying to get The Hobbit up and running.
Mm.
But yeah, what a list. I mean, Amadeus and The English Patient. I was looking him up on IMDb, and it's not like he actually produced very many films. But you know,
produced the right films.
The right films. The Mosquito Coast, which is a fantastic film. Mm. You know, like really good taste.
Mm.
Except for maybe The Hobbit. But anyway,
Another industry legend passed away recently. Sir Run Run Shaw, who founded the Hong Kong studio Shaw Brothers, which introduced the world to martial arts movies and Bruce Lee, died this week at the age of 107. Sir Run Run was also a producer on Blade Runner in 1982.
Yeah, and I was reading some more about him earlier on today, and apparently just a major, major figure in the Hong Kong social scene and philanthropic scene, and sort of, and was, yeah, just absolutely beloved there.
Mm-hmm. And in happier news, our friends at Letterboxd have announced the results of their 2013 Year in Review, the list of the highest rated movies by users on their site. Number one was 12 Years a Slave, closely followed by Before Midnight and Spike Jonze's Her. Letterboxd's statistics are based on over 11 million screenings by 86,000 members. You can find the full and fascinating results at letterboxd.com/2013.
And we will stick a link to that in the show notes and possibly tweet and Facebook it out there as well. In the next couple of days. Letterboxd turning into one of the great resources for film lovers out there. All right, now it's we're going all around the world. Maybe time to look at some high finance, low morals on Wall Street.
My name is Jordan Belfort. At the tender age of 22, I headed to the only place that befit my high-minded ambitions.
Name of the game: move the money from your client's pocket into your pocket.
But if you can make your client's money at the same time, it's advantageous to everyone. Correct?
No.
This is the greatest company in the world!
I was becoming a legend.
Aren't you married?
Yeah, but married people can't have friends.
We're not gonna be friends.
I was making so much money, I didn't know what to do with it.
$26,000 for one dinner!
Dad, we're not poor anymore.
The Wolf of Wall Street, the new film by Martin Scorsese, the new collaboration between Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio. And, boy, this has a film in recent times created as much of a stir as this one. You know, there's so much online debate and discussion. So many think pieces have come out about this, about whether it's not judgmental enough about the bad stuff that this character does. You know, it's like elevating somebody whose bad behavior should have meant that he was criticized. You know, it's like there's been a lot of talk about this, and Scorsese and his editor Thelma Schoonmaker and DiCaprio himself, they've all had to come out and defend a film that it seems to me doesn't need any defending. Has anybody else around the table seen this one yet?
You're on your own, buddy.
Oh my goodness! Sorry about that. Shaking of heads. This is one of the
three. Yeah, I know, but it's, you know,
it is three.
It's a longish film. It isn't
is.
It?
Yeah, it is a long.
Did you look at your watch, or was it just totally engrossed?
No, there was perhaps one scene where something happens, and you think, "Oh, right, there's going to be at least another 20 minutes, isn't there?" But I didn't actually look at my watch. But I did. I was aware of that. Now. This is a film that's based on a true story, based on a memoir by a guy who landed in Wall Street just before the major crash of 1987 and started to build his business out of the rubble, basically, in 88, 89. And he started a business basically selling worthless stocks, penny stocks, to people on the phone, so you know, essentially fraud, and then turning that business into selling.
But is it, Dan?
Well, yeah, he went to jail. So yeah,
oh, okay, right.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely fraud. But also then selling similarly worthless stocks, but for lots more money to people who had more money. You know, this is about separating stupid people and gullible, greedy people from their money. And this guy made millions and millions and millions, and then blew most of it on women, alcohol, and drugs, it would appear. And the film makes no bones about the fact that they had the best time. You know, like there's so much fun. There's parties, there's international travel, there's a yacht, you know. And I think a lot of people are watching this film and thinking, you know what, this makes it seem really attractive. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. That's why they did it, is because it is attractive. And it's why a young man in their 20s, when they've given millions and millions of bucks, they're going to blow it on drugs.
So does it have that same sort of Goodfellas theme of being, you know, hey, we were kings, we were like, and now I'm just a Joe Average, and it sucks, you know?
Yeah, it's almost exactly the same as Goodfellas and Casino. I watched Casino again just to make sure the other day, and I would say that these are actually a trilogy, that they are consciously connected to the same. This is about young men who want the shortcut to the good life and find that, you know, you can't sustain it, and it'll do you under eventually. And so if you think about it, I find it fascinating. There's so many people wanting to more judgment and more passion about this DiCaprio character who essentially was just a financial fraudster. But nobody, I don't remember the huge articles in magazines saying that Ray Liotta's character in Goodfellas should have been treated more harshly or judged more harshly in Goodfellas. We kind of like those wacky Italian mobster characters, don't we? You know,
absolutely.
And the same in Casino. And it's like, so why should we be harsher?
Casino to a lesser degree, though. It had less charm, I thought, than Goodfellas.
Yeah, but very similar in style, and very similar in voiceover, and in humorous scenes, and in tricksy cinematography, like freeze frames or slow motion or what have you. So as far as I'm concerned, you could say that these are actually all part of the same American Dream trilogy that Scorsese has been responsible for. The key message, it seems to me, that comes out of Wolf of Wall Street is that and you know, you only have to have lived through the most recent depression and financial crash to realize this, I reckon, is that he's pretty much the only Wall Street guy to have ever gone to jail for what he did. You know, the people, and he only lost people's money to maybe 50, 100, maybe 250 million bucks. The people on Wall Street who lost us 7 billion or trillions, or took the government's bailout money, they didn't go to jail. They got their bonuses, and they're back on top.
But isn't there an element of he wasn't from the right side of the tracks, and so that's why he got punished in such a way.
Exactly, and I think that that's a definite subtext to the movie as a whole. And actually watching Casino again and Goodfellas, you realise, again, the subtext of both of those films is that the guys at the very, very top, The people, you know, if you want to not get punished, steal lots.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, in Casino, at the end of Casino, our main characters played by De Niro and mainly by Joe Pesci and his guys, they get bumped off by the big bosses because they become an embarrassment and they're getting in the way of actually making serious money. But the guys at the very top, they stay clean and they don't get punished. And that seems to be one of the key messages of these films, is that, you know, if you're middle management and you get above your station, then, you know, trouble is on your way, you know. I thought it was a fantastically entertaining film. I thought DiCaprio was absolutely sensational. I thought that it's a really interesting to compare his character in this with Gatsby, you know, in the same year, two performances about guys wanting more than they've been given by their birthright. So, you know, I thought there was a lot to enjoy about it, definitely. And the fact that there's been so much debate, I just think is fantastic too. It means that people are watching, they're thinking. There were a lot of people sitting even though it's quite a long film, there were a lot of people sitting in the theatre waiting for the credits to roll right the way to the end and obviously wanting to go away and talk about it afterwards, largely because it doesn't make its judgments absolutely plain. It doesn't do your thinking for you, which I think, you know, makes a change these days. So I recommend you guys take, not on a sunny day like this maybe, but the next rainy afternoon, go and see The Wolf.
It's on my, I have to see it, you're right, and I will. I mean, because it's funny though, do you think that one of the things, or one of the possible outcomes of it is that history shows that they don't get penalised for these things, and that life just trucks on and they just move to the next kind of bubble. Is it that?
I think so, except that this guy, Jordan Belfort, who's at the centre of all of this, he went to jail, and it was a pretty cushy jail because financial criminals don't do the hard time that other people do. But he's not allowed to go back into that business, and he has to make his living now essentially teaching people how to sell stuff, you know, going around the world and doing seminars and what have you, including one at the very end where he's in Auckland. So, you know, he's a little bit of fame for New Zealand there at the end. And my understanding from what he's been writing online is that none of the money that he's made from his book or from the rights to the film are going in his pocket. They're all still going to pay back people that he ripped off way back in the early 90s. So, you know, you would sense that this is a kind of morality tale from his point of view. He knows that what he did was wrong, but he still sits there and goes, you know what, they were good times. it was fun. Throwing dwarfs at a dartboard was fun. So, you know, I just think that my two word for review for it would be mixed messages.
The ice, Jace. She moves like a woman. I'm Walter. Mitty.
Cheryl. Melhoff. Where have you been?
Testing the limits of the human spirit.
I'd like to climb your hair, test that out.
Perhaps I can contact you, possibly through my poetry falcon.
Poetry falcon. I like that.
Right, from the world of high finance, we're actually going to go into the imagination of, what would you call him? A rather dour...
Milk
not,
toast.
No, not dour.
Milk toast.
Milk toast. What's that then?
That's a wonderful phrase. Anyway.
You don't get to use that often.
Ben Stiller, he is responsible for remaking the Danny Kaye movie The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which originally was a short story in The New Yorker by James Thurber.
And was also a film.
That's what I just said.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah. But actually, this is not... I realised, actually looking at the credits at the end, it's not a remake of the Danny Kaye film. It's actually, they've gone back to the original story, so it just so happens that they're connected. But anyway, the story has been told once before. Simon, you have mentioned already that you've been to see it, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty with Ben Stiller, directed by Ben Stiller. I saw this quite a while ago, so I'm hoping you can jog my memory about some of the things I saw.
Yeah, me too, but I'll do my best. Yeah, I mean, Stiller plays a kind of very shy, awkward chap who... But is also very efficient in his role with Time Life, managing the sort of photographic section, and he has of course longings for Kirsten Wiig's character, who is the sort of office romance, you know, the possible office romance.
Who very weirdly plays somebody very, very similar to her character in Anchorman 2. So when you see Anchorman 2, you're going, hang on, what?
even though, and this, and he's, and at the same time, Time Life is going through a restructure. They're going to kind of cull a lot of people. It's this big change, and they're being sold, I think.
Yeah, and they're closing the magazine, and it's going to go all online. Yeah, and he, you know, he works with film, 35mm film. He's responsible for keeping those frames perfect. And of course, when it all goes digital, you know, the world's changing around him.
And the great photographer, I forgot his name, but played by Sean Penn. You know, he's supplied the cover page for the last printed edition. You know, this is it. He sent it in, and Stiller goes to find it, and it's not there. And so he goes off on this journey. I mean, prior to that, even before he goes off on this journey, though, he is having these, you know, he goes off into these dream worlds, daydreams where these amazing things happen, and he tries to portray himself in a different light, you know, and they're amazing sequences. I really enjoyed them. I have to say overall, you know, I mean, this is a journey about it. There is a romance there, but it's not necessarily about that. It's about sort of strength of character, of going on this journey and becoming a stronger person. And that's what he, you know, essentially does.
I reckon it's about the main message of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is that beards have to be earned.
Beards.
You can't just grow one.
You can't, because they don't work usually, do they? No, that's right. You've got to work at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, it's the scenes where he goes to Iceland and everything like that, and it is fantastically shot, isn't it? To look at.
One of the most beautiful things I've seen in a long time.
And you listen to people when they come out of the film, and that's the thing that they're bubbling away about is the way that it looks. I mean, still is good. I think this is a good role for him. I enjoyed him in this role.
He does all his own skateboarding.
Yeah, you really?
Most of his own skateboarding.
I know. It was pretty slick, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, that was that was probably the part where I kind of thought, really? The most, you know, like, but anyway.
I learned that you have to tape rocks to the palms of your hands if you want to go around those corners fast.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or get into a really bare-knuckle fist fight.
True.
I learned that the hard way. But there you go. I mean, so I would really recommend this film. I think it's I think it is a good film. You know, it's that PG rating at the moment, and there's a lot of good films around that are pretty tough, you know, at the moment. And it is actually probably a good family film, I think, you know, for certain ages.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's certainly there's nothing in it that you'd have a problem with your kids watching. But it felt a little bit too long to me, and it felt a little bit too pleased with itself. At times, you know, at the end, you know, there were some long, lingering glances between people, and you're thinking, come on, we get the point now, get on with it. And, you know, I wonder whether Ben Stiller, the director, is a little bit too in love with Ben Stiller, the actor. And
well, you know, how often, but how many roles does he get like this? I mean, he's pretty much
to be a hero.
Yeah, and he's pretty much had to go and make the film himself, hasn't he, to do that?
Yeah, true. Yeah. Kristen Wiig. Really, really good.
She's good, not enough, probably.
No, I think that's true. And
never enough Kristen Wiig. Never enough.
Nice David Bowie little piece by her in the film. Mm. That's a great part of the film, isn't it?
It is. And actually, what's neat about the travel, although you could, you know, and you could argue that this is, for an American audience, this is about, hey, you know what American audience is? There is a rest of the world out there.
Take a plunge.
And, you know, Afghanistan or Iceland or wherever. And they obviously went to Iceland, right? It looks amazing. And I really, really want to go. And so, you know, Stuart Dryburgh, the New Zealand cinematographer, shot it, and it is just
I was expecting somebody from Game of Thrones to pop out in the background or something. In Iceland, the sword or something.
It would reduce your audience.
Or was it Daywalker or something? You know, like, yeah.
I haven't watched Game of Thrones.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah. So Mitty, that was my only real sort of problem with it, is that I felt like it was like two and a half, and it could have been two. And perhaps not enough Sean Penn. Or maybe they would have felt like there was more Sean Penn if the film had been shorter.
I don't know if I liked his character though when I met him. Sean Penn's character.
I suppose you meant to, aren't you?
Yeah, but look, just for something to look at, I would recommend this film. To take you into these worlds and to just completely immerse you in it. Mm. I mean, the way it looks is quite spectacular. Yeah. It'd be a wee while since we've seen a film like that, I think so.
All right, so two words for The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Fantasy Wonderland.
All right. Mine, Fantastic Journey.
Remember, you're another parent, you're another therapist, you are here to create a safe environment, and that's it.
Got it.
Luis, you better be up.
Silly as I was gonna be.
Community meeting is now in session.
You need to tell me what the hell is going on.
You have to let me in your head once in a while. I'm just gonna go nuts.
We have a new member of our community.
She's been in and out of group homes for dangerous behavior. I told her father we'd take good care of her.
I take good care of everyone.
I am on the floor every day with those kids, and last night, that girl sat next to me, and she cried, and she tried to tell me the only way that she knew how.
Grace, it's not your job to interpret tears.
Opening today around the country in sort of...
Very limited.
Limited, so yeah, tight release, shall we say, via Madman Entertainment. Short term 12. This is a film that a low-budget indie... from the States that has picked up quite a lot of traction over the last wee while, and certainly there's been some murmurings about award-worthy performances here. Kaylee, you and I have seen it. Why don't you start?
Well, Short Term 12, the title may not make much sense, but it is the name of the sort of building that they work in, which is a foster care facility for kids, for troubled teens and kids who haven't quite found a space yet. They sort of grow up there with other kids.
It's a holding pattern sort of place,
yeah,
isn't it?
You know,
like while they work out what to do with them and give them some maybe some emergency therapy.
Yeah, so it's sort of like this all-in-one where they live therapy, like outreach, things like that. And it stars Brie Larson, who is absolutely fantastic. She was in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. She was the ex-girlfriend in The Addams. And she's been in quite a number of other things as well, including Don John, which unfortunately we didn't get to see in New Zealand, but a couple other films that came out recently as well. And she is sort of one of the head supervisors at this care facility for these kids. And we find out that she herself was in a similar situation. And I don't know how much to say about what happens to her character, because I don't want to give too much away. But she's come up to this very large life decision that she has to deal with while balancing working in this very difficult situation with these kids who need a lot of help. And there's a new girl comes in to the facility, and they sort of bond over shared experiences.
You get the impression that the problems that these kids have are very much drawn from life and from research. You know, that this isn't just plucked from the imaginations of a writer. This is somebody who's either spent a lot of time in those facilities and understands the kind of people that end up there, or has done a lot of research and talked to people who have.
Mm. And that's the thing that really drew me into the film, because watching it, you know that this isn't just written by, you know, it feels like this is a very, very personal story for someone who's gone through this or knows someone who, you know, had a secret writing partner who went through these things. And it also, speaking of trigger warning, reminded me of a lot of working at summer camps and dealing with kids in, you know, obviously a short amount of time, but having to have that similar training for, you know, them to be comfortable and talk to you about things and, you know, tell you their life story. And
yeah,
so it was,
but what's interesting is that our two central characters, they're not trained social workers or therapists. You know, their job is really just to serve food and keep people clean and keep people safe and make sure, you know, like it's a really basic sort of carer's role. And yet, because they spend so much time with these kids, they can't not perform a sort of therapeutic role in their lives. That was possibly the thing I had a problem with, was, you know, how likely is it that these kids will be saved by somebody who's basically there just to make sure that they don't run away, you know?
It's just like, oh god, it's just like takes your heart and rips it out, and it's so good. And it's one of those films that's just like, reminds me how great American independent cinema is. Like, these small films are just so amazing and tell these great, really personal stories. Beautifully shot, like, wonderful young cast, and I can't really say enough about how much I enjoyed it. And, you know.
Yeah, I did enjoy it, and I thought that its heart was very, very much not only in the right place, but it was on its sleeve at the same time. But I had some questions about just how how likely it was that our two central characters would have such an impact on these people's lives, bearing in mind that there's therapists and social workers and this, that and the other. So I needed to know more about how that worked. And the other question I had was how likely it would be, and, you know, maybe it is entirely appropriate that two people with similar backgrounds would end up gravitating to a job at a place like that, whether that's something that because your life was broken, you either sort of have a passion to try and heal those people, or whether that's just the circles that you end up gravitating back towards. It just seemed to me I didn't know how likely it was that the two central characters would both have had similar broken home backgrounds, and whether it works for the narrative. You know, it helps create that through line, and it's neat. I just wondered how realistic it was, that's all.
Yeah, I thought there was sort of mention that she may have grown up in a similar situation, because we meet his foster family at like a party. So he obviously had a home situation. But yeah, I don't know how it works.
Yeah, exactly. And that, and I sort of wanted to go away and find out a little bit more about it. And it certainly seemed interesting to me that the real authority figures in a home like that were so absent, and that seemed to be a really big point that the film was making, was that the big decision makers are not the ones that are spending the time with these kids to really get to know them properly. And, you know, that perhaps a state-run care facility like that, you know, isn't actually doing the right thing by these kids. But this is a film that there is a lot to get out of, but you know trigger warning is right, and I'm going to stick with it again for my two-word review on this one, because there are people that I would expect would be tempted to go and see this film, and it may remind them of things in their life or the lives of their friends or relatives, because, you know, it's all too common, the sort of stories that we hear about there. So there is, I think, a risk there, but still an amazing film and a great film, and lots of people there to look closely at in terms of their career. Yeah. Do you have two?
Yeah, my two-word review for short-term 12 is deeply personal. And I didn't see the trailer before going in. I thought it was like going to be some sort of futuristic thing. So I was a bit confused at the beginning.
That's great. I think we should make, you know what?
Because the title is just like, what? Like, what's going to happen?
Is it even possible these days to spend an entire week going to see films? Like, I'd love to do a show where all three of us go and see a couple of films, but we don't know anything about them. You know, in your job site, I don't think it's possible.
That's pretty tough. Yeah, yeah. It'll be tough. I'm sure it can be done though.
Yeah, but maybe it's only at festival time that we can really do that. That we can go in and, you know what, I can't remember what this film's about, or where it's from, or who's in it, or anything.
That seems way too brave.
Well,
just like close your eyes and like pick and be like,
yeah, that's right. That'd be good fun.
I don't know. And,
but it's another question, isn't it? How much of our enjoyment of films starts when you start anticipating it? You know, and that so much of when a film disappoints us is because it disappoints us, not because it isn't.
Yeah, I think it's when you know so little that it's this, you know, surprise, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's when it works best, I think.
I agree, but it's just so hard now to get to those situations.
Usually, you know, I find it every time my hopes are so sort of raised, and then you go, oh. Whereas, you know, if you didn't know anything about it, maybe it wouldn't be the same.
Oh, so another piece of news. Just
so less research, Dan.
Don't watch the trailers. Don't watch the trailers. Don't read the reviews.
Don't go on Twitter.
Tweets, yeah.
Don't listen to cinema. No, hold on.
Just get rid of your phone.
Yeah.
Stop reading the paper.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Maybe you should just listen to Cinematica. Just us.
Right. That'll do.
Yeah. Because you can listen to us and enjoy it without ever seeing the films. there was a piece of news announced just yesterday that the third Planet of the Apes film has been greenlit already with the same Matt Reeves, the same director. So obviously the word in the studios must be really, really hot on the new Planet of the Apes films. I now have a 10, nearly 11-year-old living with me half the time. And so we spent a bit of Christmas introducing him to The Wizard of Oz on Christmas night and the original Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes, just to see how, you know, how it worked. And beforehand it was going, are there going to be good effects? And it was like, no, probably not.
They were in their day, though.
You know, it'll be a great story.
They're not bad. They're just different. Yeah. They're handmade.
But it really got to him, that film, and he was kind of spooked by it.
Oh, so, it would be spooked. It's a spooky film. Yeah. I mean, when they take away their voices and stuff. I mean, it's a yeah.
So I just think that, you know, we're working on building a new young cinephile.
Excellent.
Yeah.
To get him on the show.
Let's hope so. All right, that is our show for this week. Short but sweet. I tell you what, I think we should. They should all be like this. Next week,
we're kids on fire, aren't we?
Kids in Nazi Germany get a wake up call in The Book Thief, and Keanu Reeves finally goes samurai for real in 47 Ronin. And no doubt that will be just the beginning of next week's show. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. The people who subscribe via iTunes are our happiest listeners because it just arrives as if by magic. You can leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Ratings, those reviews are super useful to help more people discover the show, push us up the rankings. You can contact us on social media, give us your two-word reviews, or tell us to go even faster.
You can find us on Twitter via @CinematicaCast, all one word. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. On Letterboxd, it's Cinematica, where you can read our two-word reviews. And as always, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. I thought one of the strengths of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty was the soundtrack. I think Ben Stiller has really, really good taste. This is Jose Gonzalez and Step Out from the soundtrack of that film. And that is it from me.
And me.
And me.